Previously on The Realness, we told you how Prodigy and Havoc of Mobb Deep got their start, from a couple of kids in Queens, New York, to rap icons who had helped define a generation of hip-hop.
His voice, there's a grit to it. There's a pain in Prodigy's voice that when you think about like what New York street hip-hop sounds like, to me, that is Prodigy's voice.
But for Prodigy, the story is a little bigger than that. He comes from a super artistic family.
My mom was like walking down the street somewhere. I don't know if it was Queens or whatever, wherever she was at.
His mother's name was Fatima Johnson, but she performed as Frances Collins after she got a totally random shot at the music business.
And somebody stopped her and was like, hey, can you sing? And she was like, no. And they was like, you sure we need an extra member for this group? Because one of the members had dropped out.
Frances was being recruited to join the Crystals. They had hit songs like Then He Kissed Me or The Do Run Run.
They do run, 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 they do run, run. Somebody told me that his name was Bill. They do run, 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 they do run, run. Yeah, my heart stood still. Yeah.
So they convinced her to do it. She was only 18. They convinced her to do it. And she became part of the group and went right on tour. It was just like random.
Also, Prodigy's grandmother, a woman named Bernice Johnson, ran a dance school in Jamaica, Queens.
Her students became TV stars, danced with Alvin Ailey, choreographed for Michael Jackson. And her son, Prodigy's dad, he was in a kid doo-wop group called the Chanters.
And then there was Prodigy's grandpa.
My grandfather was named Bud Johnson. He was big into jazz and like big band.
Bud Johnson Sr. was a sax player. He toured with Dizzy Gillespie. He was in a big band with Quincy Jones.
And he wrote and recorded his own stuff, like a song called Dirty Old Man. He released it in 1974, the same year Prodigy was born.
When Prodigy was a kid, he got to meet all these jazz greats when Bud would have them over to the house. Sometimes Prodigy would get to see his grandfather play live. He loved it, even if he didn't always appreciate what he was hearing.
I just didn't get it when I was a kid. Probably like, yeah, in high school when I first started making beats, then I understood like the power of my grandfather's music. Because we would sample a lot of jazz records, you know what I mean? And he left me like his collection, his jazz record collection. And we made a lot of the first album, Infamous, and Juvenile Hell from my grandfather's records.
Like a lot of rap songs back then, Mobb Deep's most famous track, Shook Ones Part 2, is made of several different samples. And one of the elements they pulled from his grandfather's collection is a gentle minor key riff that's lifted from a Herbie Hancock song called Jessica. Havoc chopped and twisted it beyond recognition, but it's there, the melodic backbone of a classic hip-hop beat. So with all of this talent right there in one family, it almost seems inevitable that Prodigy would go into the family business. Like he was born to be an entertainer.
But Prodigy's success, the kind where other rappers drew on him for inspiration, it didn't come easy. Especially when you remember that he was constantly fighting through that pain from sickle cell. It could have worn him down.
But that's not Prodigy's story. Despite his sickle cell, or maybe because of it, Prodigy became a tough kid. And when he discovered rap music as a teenager, that toughness turned into such clear-eyed confidence and determination that Prodigy knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to rock the mic. In tonight's show, we're going to tell you a couple of stories about how Mobb Deep's toughness and focus showed up from day one. Then we're going to tell you how Prodigy's success and his sickle cell collided head-on with the criminal justice system. I'm Christopher Johnson.
I'm Mary Harris. This is The Realness, a three-night broadcast series about the life of Albert Prodigy Johnson, a rap icon and half of the hip-hop duo Mobb Deep, right out of Queens, New York.
Making groundbreaking hit records for the hood and quickly becoming the most elite rappers in the world, responsible for creating one of the best eras in hip-hop history, the 90s, Nas, Mobb Deep, Wu-Tang Clan, Biggie, and Jay-Z, a changing of the guard.
Our first story goes back to the earliest days in Mobb Deep's history. This is back when Havoc and Prodigy were out hustling for a record deal, and they realized they also needed a manager. So they brought on Prodigy's mom. She'd learned a lot about the music business when she was singing with the Crystals. Okay, so 1992, Prodigy and Havoc were about 18 years old, and they'd been working the clubs and the industry parties, whatever it took.
We did a talent show, right? It was like a New York City, some talent show in New York used to do all the time.
Mobb Deep had been competing in a statewide talent contest, and they were doing pretty well. After the first few rounds, they got put on the bill for a show.
And we had those like auditions, rehearsals, or whatever it is, and we'd go into our song, and our song got curses in it. The chorus of the song go, here we go, yo, here we go. That's the whole chorus. And they like, oh, stop the music, stop me. They was like, yo, you can't curse in this talent show. We like, what? They like, you can't curse. And we walked over. My mom was like, what's wrong with y'all? So she sat us down, like, right after that. She was like, you can't do that. You can't disrespect people like that. You just take the curses out.
Now, Prodigy and Havoc were in this face-off with Prodigy's mom. These two kids who'd hardly made a dent on the rap scene versus a woman who toured with Diana Ross and the Supremes. But these kids, they just leaned in.
We was like, yo, listen, we gonna stick to what we do. You know what I mean? We don't want nobody trying to change us. If you're not gonna follow what we saying and believe in us to the maximum and everybody else, then we can't work with you no more.
And that was it. Prodigy and Havoc fired Prodigy's mom. They were so sure, so determined, so totally positive that their way, their sound, could and would prevail.
We were really hard-headed. We were really just stuck on what we were doing. Tunnel vision.
Here's Prodigy with about 25 years of hindsight.
We wasn't trying to hear nobody. We had a something that didn't really exist. Like, you know what I'm saying? It was like the vibe that we had, the you know, just the energy and the words and the style, the slang, everything was just, it wasn't nothing like that.
This attitude wasn't entirely out of the blue. The early 90s was an era of independent rap labels, indie rap radio, and successful independent artists.
So it's not totally crazy for two hip-hop upstarts like Prodigy and Havoc to think, we're going to do this our way. Mobb Deep had an almost obsessive sense of how great they wanted to be.
Which gets us to our second story. Around the same time they fired Prodigy's mom, remember that Havoc and Prodigy would stand outside of record companies with their demo tape and a Walkman, waiting for artists to walk out so that they could get them to listen. And back then, their favorite label was Def Jam. This was home to some big acts like Run DMC, LL Cool J.
Yeah, the Beastie Boys used to ride their bikes around the offices.
So Mobb Deep, they're hustling, and they finally get someone's attention at Def Jam.
They set up a meeting for us with Russell Simmons. So we go to the office to have a meeting with Russell.
Simmons co-founded Def Jam, so this meeting was a big deal. The plan was for Havoc and Prodigy to go to the Def Jam office, and someone would take them just around the corner to Russell's house. But there's a problem.
I had the gun on me, you know what I mean? The little one-shot Derringer I had bought.
Prodigy's holding, not a big gun, but still.
Before they went to Russell's place, Prodigy hands the gun to someone at Def Jam. They quietly tuck it away in a desk drawer.
I had left it in the Def Jam office because I didn't want to bring a gun in Russell's house. walked around the corner, went to Russell crib. Russell's a no-show. They like, Russell got caught up.
So they went back to the office where they met with a totally different executive. And he says to them, you guys are too young. Your music is too filthy. I can't do anything with you. Thanks, kids, but no thanks.
We was like, what the fuck is wrong with this dude? Like, you know, he didn't understand the music. We was like, all right, fuck it. We wasn't mad at anything. We was like, all right, on to the next label. So we go downstairs, and before we leave, you know, they had all these posters hanging up in the office. They had, like, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick frame. They had, like, the Ill De La Soul is Dead post. I wanted to hang it up in my room. You know, that was that back in the day shit, hanging shit up in your room and whatnot.
So before Havoc and Prodigy leave, they ask a guy at Def Jam for a few of those posters. And while he's in the back, Havoc goes into the desk drawer.
So Hav, get the gun out the drawer. And he points it at me. I'm like, yo, chill, son. He's like, I'm just playing. Calm down. I'm like, chill, don't point guns at people. So then my man come back with all the posters. He like, yo, here. He put the posters down. Then Hav pointed the gun at him. Like, yo, give me them posters.
Okay, now, take a deep breath. Havoc accidentally pulls the trigger, and he shoots the guy in the stomach.
We were there in the office, and I heard the firing of a gun. And so we all kind of had this perplexed, like, was that what we really heard? Sort of a expression.
Ali Shaheed Muhammad was at Def Jam that day. He's with the group A Tribe Called Quest.
Everything kind of just went in a slow motion. Like, it was so slow motion.
Hav drops his gun. Like, we both like, oh, shit, what the f***? Like, we in shock. You know what I mean?
Hav bolts out the door and runs downstairs.
We running up the block. I hear somebody screaming behind me. Stop them kids. Yo, stop them kids. So I'm like, I look.
And it's Ali in hot pursuit.
So I hit the corner, and I'm running up and approaching, and I see Prodigy.
Ali catches up to him, sits right down next to Prodigy.
And I asked him, I'm like, why are you carrying a gun? And he's explaining to me that there were people in school that was threatening him.
My first year of high school, there was this gang called the Decepticons. And I used to come to school in the morning, and I used to see people coming to school, my friends coming to school, the faces spliced open, like, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, what the fuck happened to you, son? He's like, yo, the Decepticons just caught us in the train station. You know, I'm like, yo, the niggas ain't cutting me like that, dog. I'm buying a gun right now, because I dare niggas try to cut me like that. So that's when I bought my first gun, because of that.
Back on that sidewalk in the middle of Manhattan, Ali says that sitting next to Prodigy and hearing his story, his heart was broken for this kid.
Knowing that he had to walk around with his backpack with a firearm, it just made me feel like, man, this life is so messed up. And I'm doing everything I can to try and comfort him, tell him that it's going to be all right. A situation like that, it can completely ruin your life, and it can shape you into a different person.
But for Prodigy and Havoc, this incident did the opposite. After they got famous, this story became proof that Mobb Deep was real. It became part of the mob's lore.
As for the guy that Havoc shot, he survived and he agreed to just let the whole thing go. And Prodigy and Havoc just kept hustling. Part of that hustle meant going to a lot of clubs, trying to get noticed, and then doing shows, and just being flashy rap stars. And there was one spot at the top of Mobb Deep's list.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ. This was the mecca of all clubs. The best club that ever opened in America.
This was the place where everybody wanted to be, especially if they were hip-hop heads. And it tells you a lot about the music business at a time that's now called the golden age of hip-hop.
It was down in Chelsea, right by the West Side Highway. And if you were in New York in the mid-90s and you liked to party, you probably know this place. It's a club called The Tunnel.
The Tunnel. My God. That club was like the most amazing club of my lifetime.
This is Shailene Evans, but that's not what most people call her. What most people know her as And some may find this name offensive, but most folks call her Chinky.
I was given that name by my dad. A lot of people ask me that question.
She met Prodigy when she was just a teenager. She sang on Mobb Deep's songs, and she was the only woman in their massive crew. And when that crew rolled, it definitely rolled to the Tunnel.
The Tunnel is my generation's Studio 54.
What's up, y'all? This is Cherub, and I am at the Tunnel Sunday night like we do every Sunday, only today is...
So for a long time, the Tunnel had been known for its techno and house dance parties. And then in the early 90s, around 1993, the guy who owned it said, why don't we try a rap party? And this was kind of a big thing because rap parties at the time, dance parties, they were known to get kind of violent. And so it was a little bit of a risk. And he said, okay, well, we'll do this on Sunday night because then if I make a little money, it's just kind of bonus and hopefully nothing goes wrong. And this place became the epicenter of hip hop in New York.
So what you do when you get to the block of the Tunnel, right? You get out your cab. You scan the line first to see if you could cut it. Okay, then the line is a party, okay? Because half of this line is not getting in. So you might as well party on the line.
And if you got through the line and the security and those massive bouncers and you actually got through the door, you get just swept up in the energy.
Man, it's mayhem. It's just people everywhere. And it's so huge. It literally looked like the space of a train tunnel. It looked that big.
80,000 square feet. Massive. There are actually train tracks down the middle of the dance floor because it used to be a space where freight trains were.
And there were little compartmental rooms in the tunnel. You would find a new one every time you went to this damn club. And these rooms used to have going on in them.
Like what?
Sucking, f***ing, snorting, smoking, this, that. The bathrooms in the tunnel was co-ed. And there were bars in the bathroom.
Shut up.
Literally, you could come out the store, grab a drink, right? Every inch of that club, it was a party.
We would be in that spot every Sunday like church. We ran through the tunnel like we owned it.
The tunnel was like the Amazon of nightclubs.
Matty C was what's known as an A&R man for Loud Records. And for folks like him, the tunnel was all about business.
He helped Mobb Deep get a deal for their second album, The Infamous.
Yeah, I mean, the tunnel was kind of like an extension of The Office for me and for most of the artists on Loud.
Part of Matty's job was to do whatever he had to do, wherever he had to do it, to make sure everybody knew about their music.
And back in the mid-90s, if you worked for a rap act, if you were in a rap act, and you wanted to be taken seriously, you found your way into the tunnel.
Pretty much every big name group came through the tunnel as kind of a way to debut if they were really on that level.
Puff Daddy and Biggie and their whole entourage were up in there.
Puffy was actually known for lining up champagne bottles on the bar when he was done with them.
Nas was there, and the Wu-Tang and their enormous clan, even former NWA heads, guys all the way from Cali would head to the tunnel. One thing that made this club so important to groups like Mobb Deep was a DJ named Funkmaster Flex.
Hold on, Funkmaster Flex? Not a DJ. The DJ. He had the tunnel popping all the time. Are you kidding?
Back then, Funkmaster Flex was one of the hottest DJs in New York.
WQHT New York.
He worked at Hot 97, which isn't just a local radio station. It's an institution for bringing new talent and veteran MCs to the air. So getting Flex's attention could really help make an artist.
When Flex dropped The Mob in the tunnel, it was mayhem. Half of the club is kind of like doing the whole slam dance thing. pushing and grabbing, and I was too little for that, so I'm going to the other side. It was like, you just got this feeling that came over you because you was a part of it. Like, I was a part of it. You know what I'm saying?
For Mobb Deep, it had been a slog to get to this place. Making money, traveling the world, fans everywhere. Havoc and Prodigy were celebrities. They had good reason to celebrate at the Tunnel.
This dude named Chris Lighty, a well-known manager and party promoter, ran the door.
And with that fame and success, Prodigy's feeling that he needed to do whatever it took to protect himself, it was at a whole other level.
We got so comfortable with him, and one night, I pulled him to the side and gave him a gun to sneak in. He did it. One gun became two, two became three, and the next thing you know, I was handing him book bags full of knives, shanks, screwdrivers, guns, plus other sharp and blunt objects. Chris handed the bags off to me in the bathroom, and I passed the tools out to the boys. Try to understand. Number one, we're famous. And number two, every hood in the tri-state area was in that club, and it was dangerous.
Prodigy's relationship with guns would cause him trouble over and over and over again. And not just with the cops, but with his own sickle cell.
That's next on The Realness.
I'm Tabitha Soren, and this is The Week in Rock.
September 13th, 1996.
An actor, Tupac Shakur, is dead at the age of 25.
Tupac Shakur dies in Las Vegas after a drive-by shooting.
I cried like my mother cried when Marvin Gaye died.
In their obituary, the New York Times called Pac a rapper who quote-unquote personified violence. Tupac spent years trading insults with East Coast MCs. Biggie and Puffy, mostly. But Mobb Deep, too. He'd even made fun of Prodigy's sickle cell with the song Hit 'Em Up.
Oh yeah, Mobb Deep. You wanna f with us, you little young? Cause no one of you got sickle cell or something. You f with me, you f around have a seizure or heart attack. You better back the f up before you get smacked the f up.
When Tupac died, Mobb Deep had just released their own track that aimed straight for Tupac's head.
Who shot ya? You probably scream louder than an opera. New York gotcha. Now you wanna use my mob as a crutch. What you think you can't get bucked again, once again? Back in the house once again. Live the life that a diamonds and guns and now gems pull cat.
This is basically a thinly veiled diss track. It's aimed right at Tupac. They never actually say his name, but everybody knows who Mobb Deep is talking about.
Like a bass head, pull on steps. The mall got the ball, run out and tell a friend, drop a jam on.
When Tupac died, Mobb Deep pulled the song off the radio out of respect for Tupac's family.
For a lot of folks outside of hip-hop, Tupac's murder in 96 came to epitomize the violence in rap culture. It shaped the way folks thought about artists like Prodigy. And that's where our next story begins, because right after Tupac's death made international news, Prodigy was arrested in Hempstead, Long Island. By this time, he was pretty famous, but Risco couldn't have cared less.
He's just an up-and-coming musician to me who could be big. Okay, I mean, but who? That didn't mean anything to me.
Risco mentioned Lewis was in charge of prosecuting him.
You know, a lot of people think black people should be defense attorneys. Why are you a prosecutor? Oh, you're a sellout.
She is a tough black prosecutor from the old school.
I actually had a black woman in a jury, an old black woman. I was smiling at her, saying hello, and she whispered in my ear, you sellout, you traitor. I always thought that was funny. She don't know me, so I don't care what she thinks.
A few years before she met him, Prodigy had been arrested with a pistol in his pocket. Guns were starting to become a big part of his life. He was involved in that shooting at the record label. He was sneaking guns into the Tunnel.
As for that arrest, he was sentenced as a youthful offender, which meant he had to check in once a month with his probation officer. And he did that for a while. But then Prodigy got famous, and then he stopped showing up. His probation officer issued a warrant for his arrest.
So I got hired to deal with the violation of probation. That was the first case I had with him.
Irv Cohen is a lawyer who represented Prodigy in almost all of his adult criminal cases, starting with this one.
So we have these hearings, you know, and it keeps getting postponed.
Postponed because Prodigy kept getting sick.
And occasionally when we go to court, my client's not, he's not there. Prodigy's not there because now he's back in the hospital again, even during the violation proceedings, right? Well, apparently this pissed off the judge.
So Irv came up with a plan. He filed medical record after medical record, 90 pages total. He wanted to prove that Prodigy was too sick to show up to his probation visits and too sick to show up for court.
Prodigy misses hearing after hearing. And if you look at those court documents, you can see just how skeptical the judge is about this whole case.
Actually, let me just read to you from the transcript. The judge says, you know, there has to be an end to this thing. When is that going to happen? Is it going to happen in my lifetime or your lifetime or the district attorney's lifetime?
I actually remember the assistant district attorney helping me because she was not happy with what the judge was doing.
I didn't learn until after. You're supposed to kind of, I don't know, go along, I guess, on probation cases because, you know, it's really probation is saying this person did wrong and you're supposed to do what probation asks. But for whatever reason, it's just not my nature, you know.
Now, Risco was supposed to be prosecuting Prodigy, but she saw those medical records, all those hospital visits, and she felt for him. The judge didn't.
And the judge was saying, I mean, I think the thing that stuck out most to me was when he said, I read the medical records, and so I remember reading it said, patients resting comfortably. And the judge said, oh, that meant he was faking before. And I said, no, it meant he was suffering before, and now he's resting comfortably. He wanted me to use that as evidence that he was not in pain.
Prodigy's lawyer, Irv, tried one more tactic. He got a doctor up on the stand to testify about sickle cell. And he asked the physician if getting locked up could actually be dangerous for someone like Prodigy.
But this seemed to make the judge angry. He basically asks Risco to object. And she remembers thinking to herself,
if you want to object, you can come down and take a pay cut and take my job and object. Otherwise, I'm going to do my job and you do yours. But I'm hoping I didn't say that out loud.
At this point, the judge seems to be the only person involved in this case who's actually arguing against Prodigy. Again, this is in the court transcript. The judge says, quote, if the district attorney is not going to object, then I'm objecting and I'm sustaining my objection. Eventually, he ruled against Prodigy, sentenced him to 1 to 3 years in state prison.
It just didn't make any sense to me, except for the fact it was bias.
Later, Prodigy would call this judge the most racist judge in Nassau County. But, you know, I asked Risco if racism is what she saw when she was in that courtroom, and she shook her head.
Maybe he just thought the kid was full crap. And let's face it, he was no angel. So I can't say why the judge acted that way. I can't say it was racism. It could have just been ageism. Like, you know, I'm old, you're a rapper, and I don't like rap.
Risco says, just think about when this trial was taking place. It got started just as Tupac was killed in Vegas. And by the time it finished, Biggie was dead too.
Rap wasn't exactly positive back then. You might as well have said rap criminal. So it might have not so much been about race and more about he was a rapper and he was young.
When this judge looked at Prodigy's medical records, he saw something really different than what Risco saw or what Prodigy's lawyer saw, any of those lawyers arguing in front of him. So I asked someone else, totally, to translate these documents.
Increased pain, got morphine, report.
So you can read them. I was like, I don't think
so. Yeah, I can read it. Mm-hmm. It's scratched, but I can read it normally.
His name is Dr. Wally Smith. How long have you been treating sickle cell?
I've been taking care of sickle cell since 1984.
Dr. Smith researches sickle cell, and he takes care of about 400 patients at Virginia Commonwealth University. Yeah, the early ones seem to just say walk out.
That's what that meant? Walk out. Couldn't read that word. Left AMA. Yeah, that means he left against medical advice.
So in these records, you really can see inside P's body. he keeps getting these bone scans, scans of his clavicle, his left leg, his right arm. All of these bones are severely damaged. He has what's called fish mouth vertebra, which is when your backbone is literally wearing away. One doctor told me, like, it's kind of like they're rotting.
Yes, that's a good word. Rotting is a very good word. Truly, it is occurring in every long bone all over the body.
I asked Wally to explain just what was going on here, and he said you can think about what's going on in Pete's body sort of like a heart attack, but in your bones.
That means no oxygen is getting to the bone. It's a deep ache. Myocardial ischemia is what leads to a heart attack. This could be thought of as a bone attack. It's just no pain like you've ever had before. It's gnawing, it's deep. It doesn't go away until the ischemia itself goes away. That can take days to weeks.
P was also getting something called acute chest syndrome. This is one of the worst side effects of sickle cell. It's actually one of the leading causes of death in sickle cell patients who are his age.
Acute chest is basically a crisis that occurs in the lung itself. The blood vessels of the lung essentially get sickled blood in them.
Tell me about that. If he had four instances of acute chest, what does that mean?
That's a harbinger of bad things to come. Each one of those could have killed him.
When you listen to Prodigy's music, one of the things that P is known for is being a storyteller. And then you look at these medical records and you see his body breaking down. It's a whole other story about Prodigy that most of us don't know.
Can we talk a little bit about, you know, at this time, 95, 96, he's early 20s.
22. Yep.
What is that time period like for someone with sickle cell?
It's hell.
You know, the first time I talked to Dr. Smith, he told me that one of the biggest problems with being a young adult with sickle cell, someone like Prodigy at this age, is that you're just not cute anymore, the way you were when you were diagnosed, when you were just a baby.
They lose their insurance. They move out of the house. They're into it with their parents about their behaviors. Boy, you better stop all that drinking and smoking and don't use those drugs. They stop going to the doctor. They think they're invincible. Take sickle cell away for a minute. This is just normal adolescence. Throw sickle cell on top of that, and it unfortunately is not uncommon for them to die.
It's not uncommon for them to die?
I'm making a statement based on facts, ma'am. I've got the records and the studies to back me up.
I asked Dr. Smith to look at one last record with me. It is A268 at the top of the page. It's a little chicken scratchy, but...
It is.
This is from right before Christmas, 1996.
Social history. Ex-smoker. Denies intravenous drug abuse. Doubt that very much. Patient is non-compliant and has no regular primary medical doctor. Comes to hospital frequently for morphine sulfate for pain. States only morphine sulfate helps.
So when you see these kind of comments, what do you think about that?
Prejudice.
That's a strong statement.
It's prejudice. Let's analyze that term, non-compliant. That's a pejorative term. We don't use that term anymore. It implies that you made a rule and that they broke the rule. Another pejorative statement, insists that only morphine sulfate helps. Well, most patients have been experienced enough with their pain to know what works for them and maybe even what dose works for them. It doesn't help that he's a young black man. It doesn't help that he doesn't have a doctor who knows him and can vouch for him. And it probably is true that he is defiant and oppositional when he comes to the hospital because he's expected that he's going to be treated badly. And so it's just, you know, nobody's trusting anybody. That's what I read into all of this. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but that's what I read into it.
Do you remember how the case ended?
Yes, I do, because it was quite hilarious.
After the judge found Prodigy guilty, Risco has this picture in her mind of his lawyer rushing out like he's in a courtroom drama.
And it might not have happened this quickly, but it seemed to me that when the judge ruled against him, then the defense attorney was going to appeal. And it seemed like we went into the hallway and made a phone call. And he asked me if I would get on the phone and tell the truth. And of course, I try to always do that. But I thought that he won the appeal, but I'm not sure. He certainly should have.
Prodigy did win his appeal. His sentence was overturned. He only spent about a week in jail. While we were talking, at some point, Risco stared off in the middle distance.
It's crazy this case came back. It's two cases.
And she kind of talked to herself off mic.
And I was just saying there are two cases in my life that I recall. This one and another trial I had that were kind of pivotal in my life.
What makes you recall them both? Did they share anything?
I think seeing the humanity of the defendants.
This short case changed the way Risco saw her job. Eventually, she stopped working as a prosecutor.
I think as a you know what it is? As a prosecutor, you never get to see a person's life. I read about his illness. I read about him being in pain in the hospital. I read about him writhing in pain in the bed. You know, I read about him.
Risco's still in law enforcement. She works as a deputy police commissioner. But her passion, what she loves doing, is mentoring men who've just been released from prison, not arresting them. Do you feel like you've seen the system change as you've worked in it?
I'm not sure. You know, I'm not really sure. I think that it's, I think we're trying to change it.
Even though she didn't want to call this judge a racist, she did think his ruling was tied up in race. She told me, we're just 45 years out from what she called apartheid in this country. She thinks we've come a long way, just not far enough. Do you think that case could just as easily happen today?
It does. Every day, someplace. It's just the way it is, unless you have people who are willing to do justice, and no matter the consequence to themselves.
For Prodigy, this case was a blip. It doesn't even take up a single page in his autobiography. But in one way, it did change his life. Because afterwards, the doctor who testified about Prodigy's sickle cell, that doctor became his personal physician. And Prodigy started going to one of the world's best sickle cell centers. It was up in the Bronx, and it was a vital resource for sickle cell patients all over New York City. 20 years later, the people who took care of Prodigy there still remember him.
Well, yeah, I did what I said I wouldn't do, which is to talk about him. But okay, sure. He was true to himself.
We'll be right back after the break. On Prodigy's first solo album, HNIC, he's got what is, as far as I know anyway, the only song that he ever wrote that's explicitly about his life with sickle cell anemia.
A lot of Prodigy's tracks talk about violence, but this track, it's called You Can Never Feel My Pain. It's intense in a different way.
Sedated with morphine as a little kid. I built a tolerance for drugs, addicted to the medicine. Now hospital emergency, treat me like a fiend. A rabid dot some time I wish an OD.
Prodigy seems angry at just about everyone, including the doctors and nurses all around him.
He's talking about showing up at the hospital, needing medication for his pain, and having to prove how sick he is. And one of the last lines in his song, doctors call the cops on me because I be throwing IV poles and they ignore me. That line, it really got us thinking about Prodigy's life as a patient.
You
can never feel the pain.
I mean, and there was one time cops came in and cuffed him, I think. I can't remember, because he was erratic and he was going berserk and he was throwing things because he needed morphine.
Prodigy's brother, Greg Collins, took him on some of those hospital visits. So a lot of what Prodigy rhymes about in this song, Greg actually got to see it firsthand, and it was painful for him to watch.
You know, that was, man, you're talking about tough. And we sat and we've laughed about things, how he scared the bejesus out of people, scared the nurses, scared. Oh my gosh, man. Just scared people, and you know, they didn't want to get near him. They didn't want to help him. You know, it was ugly. It was, yeah, like dealing with a monster.
But there was a place where Greg said that doctors and nurses saw his brother differently. They knew him. It was at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx.
So I did know of him, but I didn't know who he was. Like, I'm not a rap star admirer.
Cassandra Dobson is a nurse who treated Prodigy.
He even gave me a CD to give to my daughter. And so when I gave it to my daughter, she said, oh, you know Prodigy? I said, who is Prodigy? Like, what is wrong with him? Why is he in the hospital? And I never told her, you know, confidentiality. She says, does he have sickle cell? And I said, I don't know. I cannot discuss that with you.
Prodigy was sent to Montefiore in the middle of that probation violation trial. This was one of just 10 comprehensive care centers for sickle cell anemia in the country, and all of them were funded by the National Institutes of Health.
These centers were established when Nixon signed the Sickle Cell Anemia Control Act back in 1972. And Cassandra, she worked at this hospital for years. She ended up really liking Prodigy, just not the first time they met.
He was so angry. I will never forget that. He literally took a table, you know, the nightstand, the patient nightstand, and just threw it at the door towards the physician and myself. And I went, oh, no, you're not going to do that. I said, what is the problem? He was carrying on. You don't know what it's like. I have sickle cell disease and everyone want to F me up. And I said, I realize you may be in some pain, but this is not how you show pain.
Did it help that you also have sickle cell disease?
That's one thing I told him.
Cassandra herself was diagnosed with sickle cell when she was 9 years old.
And I said, do you know I have sickle cell disease? He says, no. What type do you have? I said, well, I have the worst kind. I said, I think I have the same as you. You know, but you don't see me carrying on like that.
This story about Prodigy throwing a table across the room, Cassandra seems to have almost expected this kind of behavior from her sickle cell patients.
Some patients, because they don't get the attention that they need from the healthcare workers, will carry on in a manner that is not conducive for a normal person. So they will have these temper tantrum. It's like a 2-year-old. They'll have a temper tantrum because I want what I want when I want it, and you're not giving it to me, and this is what I want. And that's what he was going through.
Cassandra said to understand what it was like when Prodigy came to this center, I should talk to one more person, Dr. Larry Citrin. He treated Prodigy too. Can we talk about Prodigy a little bit? You know, what was your relationship with him?
There's a few things about this. First of all, I guess if he's not alive, there's no issue of confidentiality, but I don't really know that. So I should probably check that before I talk much about him. I will tell you that, you know, our kids knew who he was. I mean, apart from me, they knew his music and, yeah. You know, one thought I had, although I'm going to do something which is probably not prudent, which is continue to talk. You know, I don't even know how do I know you are who you say you are and the purposes of the conversation. So I'm trying to make sure that whatever I say,
oh, sure.
I don't bear under any circumstances.
Google Mary Harris WNYC if you're in front of a computer.
I did.
And you see me, right?
Well, I see it on the computer, but I could also Google, you know, Santa Claus.
Dr. Citrin didn't really want to talk about Prodigy, but the sickle cell center, that he would talk about. He spoke about it almost wistfully.
it was like a little day hospital. There would be 6 beds. There would be nurses and nurse practitioners, and there would be at least one physician available on call or physically available usually.
What Dr. Citrin is calling a day hospital was what's known as an infusion room, a place sickle cell patients could get intravenous medication.
It was from about 8 in the morning or 9 in the morning until about 4 in the afternoon or 5 in the afternoon.
If a sickle cell patient was in pain, they could just call up the center
and leave a voicemail message. And the first 6 people who called would have a bed. They would be called back. That's the first thing when the center opened. And they would be told, your bed is ready. Come on in. And it would be a first call, first serve basis with pain.
This clinic solved a problem that all sickle cell patients have. What do you do when you're in terrible pain? You've taken your pain pills, but you still aren't getting any relief.
Prodigy had gotten used to going to the ER, but doctors and nurses in the emergency room weren't necessarily sure what to do with a sickle cell patient. You could see it in those medical records that were filed in court. He saw a new doctor every time. They struggled to know how to treat him. The people here knew just what to do.
And so at the end of the shift, which is about 8 hours, they could leave without having had to go to the emergency room, where pain control is much more difficult to accomplish.
And the patients liked this. But here's the thing. Going to the ER all the time, it's also really expensive. The lifetime cost of treating the average sickle cell patient is nearly $500,000, mostly because of all that time in the hospital. And at this sickle cell clinic, patients could avoid all that.
The patients and the staff, all of us, had very direct personal relationships with the people we were taking care of. They knew us. We knew them. It was pretty personal.
I mean, the one story I heard was that there was a moment where you talked to Prodigy about his opioid use.
I talked to most of my patients about it.
Yeah.
He was tough. I did what I said I wouldn't do, which is to talk about him. But okay, sure. He was true to himself. Whatever he said, he believed. Whatever he said that he would or wouldn't do, whatever of what I might have suggested that he should do or shouldn't do that he didn't agree with, he was willing to take the consequences. And he would do it, I don't know, with a smile on his face exactly, but he would do it with a clean conscience and a strong heart.
Dr. Citrin's got a lot of patience, but clearly Prodigy had an impact on him.
I should probably stop, but I think this is the simplest way to put it is that he walked the walk. He's a very smart person, too.
Yeah, that's what everyone says. Everyone's like, he was like deep.
Yes, yeah.
Despite all the good this place did for sickle cell patients in New York, in 2008, the NIH withdrew funding for the center and all of its centers around the country. Dr. Citrin was there when the funding got cut.
I tend to be willfully naive or out of the loop, so I didn't know it was coming to an end, although I think that knowledge probably was available. And I think when it became sort of public to our patients, it was a couple of months before it actually closed.
There was still a clinic, but a lot of the time it was just one doctor seeing patients. No social workers, no nurse practitioners, no infusion room.
And it was moved to a location that was kind of like hiding a book in a library. It moved to a location where numerous other outpatient services were seeing patients at the same time.
When I called up sickle cell specialists all over the country to talk to them about these centers and why they closed, they spoke about this decision in a way I just wasn't used to hearing doctors talk. They were frustrated. One doctor at Johns Hopkins said, "Holy cow, what a dumb idea."
When you came here, how many people were working on sickle cell?
I was the director of myself.
Today, Dr. Katarina Minniti is in charge of Montefiore's sickle cell program in the Bronx. She's been trying to build the clinic back up over the last few years.
And I have to tell you that my patients here, the ones that remember, they still beg me. And they say, "Dr. Minniti, why don't we have the infusion room?"
So you still have patients who talk about
Oh, I do. I do. I really do. Yes, I do have patients that I still remember vividly the infusion room.
What was it about that place that makes them like keep asking for it to come back?
First of all, it was immediate access to care. Secondly, was the sense of home. They would not be judged or mistreated or considered addicts.
Dr. Minetti says the NIH defunded these centers because it wanted to research better treatments for sickle cell, even a cure.
But you cannot do research without care. That's what is fundamental to understand.
A decade after these centers closed, here's where things stand. According to the most recent data we have, the median age of death for adults with sickle cell hasn't changed for four decades. Men die around age 41. Women die a couple of years later. Doctors can't be sure, but they think it's because comprehensive care is so hard to find.
Cassandra Dobson, that nurse who once treated Prodigy, she remembers seeing him one last time. She says he just collapsed on stage during a show.
And I even remember saying to him, why don't you develop an organization where you are the manager and you get other people that don't have sickle cell to sing? You don't have to sing because you're going to get dehydrated. You're going to be sweating like a horse. You're going to be trying to run around the stage singing and you're going to collapse. I remember saying that to him because you're going to become so dehydrated.
So you were worried about his health when he was touring?
Definitely. Definitely.
Because I know that he was on tour like hundreds of days a year.
Consistently, yes. And that's one thing you cannot do when you have sickle cell. He said that he loved what he was doing. He did say that. He loved music. He loved rapping. He's sending a message to the world. I think the message could have been sent on a different platform, you know, without you trying to kill yourself.
So you worried about him dying young?
It really, I was so hurt when I heard that he died. I literally had to stop, just pray and cried. Because he was in his 40s.
Is that young?
It's for now, for sickle cell patients. It should not have happened.
When Prodigy died, all of Cassandra's concerns came true. But that's not where our story ends. Not yet. Because in 2008, just as all these centers were closing, changing the lives of countless sickle cell patients, that same year, Prodigy's life was also turned upside down.
Next time on The Realness, we'll take you up north to the Mid-State Correctional Facility where all of those years of carrying a gun illegally finally caught up with Prodigy.
When I realized I had to go to jail for 3 years, in my mind, I was like, all right, I'm going to jail from the hospital so I can get my medication every day.
This is the second of a three-night special broadcast of The Realness. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, head over to therealness.org. You can find the whole series. You can hear how Mobb Deep got their start in the music business and a special bonus episode with Queensbridge legend Roxanne Shanté.
The Realness is a production of WNYC Studios, hosted by me, Christopher Johnson, and Mary Harris.
Our editor is Christopher Wirth. We had help from consulting producer Kathy Yandley and associate producer Aaron Mathewson.
Jared Paul is our engineer. Casey Means is our technical director. Our team includes Merritt Jacob, Amanda Aronchik, and Audrey Quinn, along with Stephen Renault, Caitlin Sullivan, Ariana Jones, and Nikki Gautland. WNYC's vice president of news is Jim Schachter.
Trumpeter Christian Scott wrote our beautiful theme song and composed a lot of the music in this series.
Additional music by Melanie Sue. Thanks also to Buck 50 Productions for sound from the audiobook and to Street Funk TV for the audio from The Tunnel.
WNYC's health coverage and The Realness is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Jane and Gerald Katcher and the Katcher Family Foundation, Science Sandbox, an initiative of the Simons Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.